Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Secret Duke by Joe Beverly, narrated by Susan Duoden. Chapter 1. Dover, 1760. Laughter can take many forms, from the pure delight of a happy child to the gibber of madness. The laughter that slithered out into the dark and misty Dover night was the sound of cruel men with a victim in their clutches. It caused the man in the street to pause. To his left, waters slapped against the wharf, and wind rattled the riggings of ships. Farther out, rough water jangled a buoy bell. To his right, lanterns outside buildings were gleaming globes in the sea mist, giving only enough light for passers-by to avoid the larger detritus of any port, snarls of rope, soggy bales, and broken casks leaking stinking contents. He shook his head and moved on, but then the laughter came again, this time punctuated by one sharp word. He couldn't tell what word, but the voice sounded female. It could be a ship's lad being teased, or a whore well used to this rough area. No concern of his. But then he heard a few more words, higher pitched, but almost authoritative. Not a lad. Almost certainly not a whore. But what decent woman would be down here, late on a chilly October night? Damn it all to Hades. He'd been at sea for two cold days and nights, and anticipated a fine meal and warm bed at the Compass, and then home tomorrow. He waited and heard no more. There, whatever the commotion, it was over. But then raised jeers made him curse again and turn toward the noise. One of the misty globes probably marked the entrance to the place, but he couldn't see more than that. As he came closer, he saw only two small windows, one on either side of a cockeyed door, covered by slatted shutters that let out mean slices of tallow light. Tobacco smoke slithered out as well, along with the smell of ale, new and old, and human stink. It was a port tavern of the lowest sort, a haunt for the roughest of sailors and shore workers. A coarse voice sneered something about tits. The woman didn't respond. Was unable to respond? As he reached for the door, he saw a roughly painted sign nailed above it, indicating that this place rejoiced in the name the Black Rat. "And a plague on the lot of you," muttered Captain Rose as he shouldered open the warped planked door. He'd been right about the smoke and tallow light, and it made the room foggy, but he could see enough. The Rat was crowded, and most of the men were still sitting on their stools and benches, drinking from pots and tankards, but they'd all turned to watch the entertainment. In the corner to his right, five men had a woman trapped. Perhaps she'd been herded there as soon as she unwisely entered. What in Hades had she been thinking? Even at a glance, he recognized youth and good birth. Her brown and cream-striped gown had cost a pretty penny, and her hair curled out from a dainty cap trimmed with lace. And, yes, the swell behind the fichu that filled in her low bodice suggested she had fine tits. One of her captors was teasingly trying to snatch away the filmy cloth, playing cat and mouse, but sure of victory. She slapped at his hand. The man laughed. Rose looked around for allies, but saw no one he knew. There was one other woman present, but she was a hard-faced 40 or so and was guarding the big cask of ale, the tavern keeper or his wife, but showing no sign of interfering. She continued to fill pots and tankards as requested and take the coins. He was on his own, against five, and now drinkers were beginning to notice his arrival, nudging one another and muttering. Not surprising, he was as alien here as she. His dark suit was old-fashioned, but of excellent quality. He wore his hair loose to his shoulders and had days of beard on his chin, but these men would recognize rank and authority. Rank and authority might help him, or it might get his throat cut. Easy enough to tip a body off the nearby quay, and no one would be any the wiser. In places such as these, no one tattled. Someone might recognize him. Captain Rose's red neckcloth and skull earrings were meant to be noticed, but that wouldn't protect him if they turned on him. He saw neither recognition nor hostility as yet, only interest in a new actor on the stage and hope that he'd provide even more free entertainment. Rose turned his attention back to the scene in the corner. Yes, a lady. He knew by her clothes, but also by her carriage and the outrage flashing in her eyes. What? Had she expected the habitués of a place like the Black Rat to be gentlemen? Both haughty manner and generous figure were going to get her raped. Even these rascals might object to tormenting a terrified weakling, but such a bold piece would look like fair game to them, especially if she'd come in here by her own choice. Had she been looking for this sort of adventure? Some ladies thought rough men exciting, but she'd have to be mad to sink this low. And despite an attempt at dignity, she was young, perhaps not 18, surely too young for such depravity. As a couple of the tormentors sensed something and turned to confront him, he wondered if he could use insanity to free her. One of the two men was scarred and sinewy, but the other was an ox, all hard, beefy muscle with a low, bony forehead. Getting the chit out of here without bloodshed wasn't going to be easy, and the bloodshed could well be his own. The shorter man had slid out a long filleting knife. It would be razor sharp. Too late to rethink now. As with any feral animals, it would be disastrous to show fear, even if his heart beat fast with it. And in truth, he couldn't abandon the foolish creature. He strode forward, pushing his way roughly between tables. "So there you are, you dim trull," he blasted in the voice he used to call instructions in a gale. "What in Hades do you think you're doing, wandering about down here?" None of the tormentors moved, nor did their victim, except to stare at him. He saw then how stretched her courage was. The whites showed around her eyes. He hoped his weren't the same. "Play your part, damn you," he thought as he assessed the danger around them. Probably the only immediate danger was from the two who'd faced him, but at the slightest sign of fear, they'd all be on him like a pack of mangy dogs. He had a pistol in his pocket, but that was only one shot. He had a blade too, but he didn't fool himself that he'd win a knife fight, and to show either weapon now would indicate fear. There was no way out of this but through it, so he brushed past the two men as if unaware of them, grabbed her arm and snarled, "Come on." She instinctively pulled back, but then complied by one step. It probably looked right for a woman caught in folly by an angry husband or guardian. When Rose directed them toward the door, however, the two men moved solidly in his way.
"Your little lady came a-visitin',"
said the ox, flexing his big hands. Clearly he thought them the only weapon he needed, and he was probably right.
"Reckon she's ours now."
"She's my wife," Rose said in a weary tone he hoped would get some sympathy. "And half out of her wits, as you can see. Let us be."
"I don't mind if she's a knock in the cradle," said the man with the knife. "As long as she's got big tits."
He showed dirty, broken teeth.
"We want to see her tits."
"Oh, hell."
"I think not," Rose said, and moved his left hand to his right wrist, then turned it, holding a knife. The method usually impressed his foes, for he kept the knife in a cunning sheath on his right forearm so that its appearance seemed magical. In that moment of distraction, he took his pistol out of his right pocket. He was left-handed, but moderately ambidextrous, and the pistol was small and specially made so he could easily cock it one-handed. Too small for distance work, but it'd stop a man at this range. The shorter man eyed the weapons through slitted eyes, wary, but assessing his chances. The ox chewed the cud, clearly wishing he were grinding someone between his teeth. Would they stop him again? He tested the situation by moving a step to the side. The two men moved to block him. The knife man said to the others,
"Come on, mates, he's one man, and a fribbly type from the look of those weapons. Call that a knife? Let's get him."
The group stirred, but was undecided.
Rose raised the pistol to point directly at the knife man's left eye. You die first. Into the frozen silence, a voice rose at the back of the room. An elderly voice, but strong.
That's Captain Rose, lad. Don't know as I'd take him on myself.
Most of the room turned toward the speaker, but not the two dangerous men. Captain Rose kept his eyes on them.
A flower? Sneered the knife man. I'll pluck his pretty petals for him.
His companions sniggered, but they shifted like wet sand, uncertain.
Captain Rose of the Black Swan,
the same helpful voice called.
Broke the arm of the last man to pull a knife on him.
The three other villains backed away a bit. Rose had no idea who the speaker was, but silently thanked him, though he hoped he wouldn't have to live up to the billing. Captain Rose and his ship, the Black Swan, were well known along this stretch of the south coast. Most of the time, the Swan engaged in general trade, but sometimes she sailed off on illicit business across the channel. He'd made sure that people along the coast knew the Black Swan's business didn't benefit the French, especially during the recent war. Even the lowest Kentish sea rat wouldn't take kindly to anyone who favoured their ancient enemy. All the local people knew Captain Rose of the Black Swan was a loyal Englishman and a good seaman. But he was known for other things as well, for enjoying a fistfight, and yes, for objecting to anyone drawing a weapon on him. But there were two Captain Roses, and he was the other one. He was the Duke of Eyethorn, known to his friends as Thorn. The other Captain Rose was Caleb, his illegitimate half-brother. Thorn was as good a seaman as Caleb, and perhaps even better, but he had no taste for meaningless fighting and little skill in a brawl. Other than that, Caleb and he were as close in appearance as two peas in a pod. The slight differences in their features were masked by dark stubble that sometimes became a beard. To make the illusion complete, Captain Rose wore distinctive clothes, an old-fashioned black frock coat and a scarlet neckcloth, and an earring in the form of a skull with ruby eyes. People generally saw what they expected to see, so the outward trappings meant that the man inside was Captain Rose of the Black Swan. Most of the time, Caleb was master of the Swan, but that being the case, his reputation stuck to Captain Rose, who was generally known as a gregarious womanizer and fearless brawler. He leapt into a fist fight with glee, especially when he'd been drinking, and then afterward drank cheerfully with his opponents, as long as they'd not pulled a weapon on him. He took knives as a personal affront and would leave the offender in pieces. Perhaps Caleb's reputation would tip the scales here. I'm Rose, right enough, so heed the man and get out of my way. The ox's brow lowered.
You're still only one.
One of one can be more than one of another. The ox stared, baffled. A nearby man said,
I've heard of Captain Rose, but never that he was married.
Not quite blessed by the church, Thorn admitted. Amid laughter, one of the wary brutes sneered,
For that sort of lay, I'd pick a sweeter nature than.
Perhaps I enjoy a wench with spirit, he parried.
Spicy in bed as well, is she?
Exceedingly. He tossed it out, simply to annoy the idiotic cause of this mess, but then recognised his mistake. New interest stirred in the room as a whole. A pot flew by, spraying ale, and thunked into the side of the knife man's head. He cried out, put hand to head, staggered, and then collapsed to his knees.
Hey, that was my pot, woman!
Someone protested, but weakly. Thorn was cursing himself. That conversation had been a distraction, and he'd fallen for it, but she'd kept her wits about her. He stepped back until he was by her side.
Good aim, ma'am.
Thank you, sir, she said tightly. But I have no more ammunition within reach.
He passed her his pistol. It's cocked, so be careful. She took it, but as if she'd never handled a gun before. Point it upward, he said hastily. We wouldn't want to kill anyone. Not by accident, at least, he added deliberately. Finally, the men were backing away. Clearly, the sight of a gun in the hands of a woman was more frightening than the same gun in a man's, especially when the woman had no idea what to do with it. Thorn fought laughter, praying the girl wouldn't shoot anyone by accident. especially him. Just perhaps, however, the tide was turning in his favour. The knife man was still glazed. She'd hit him well. The ox seemed truly bovine without him. He dug in his breeches pocket, feeling the coins there. What was the right amount for the situation? He didn't want to inflame new greed, but he wanted to offer enough to get them out of here. He took out a silver sixpence and tossed it to the man who'd lost his drink.
"Thank ye, sir,"
the man said with a gap-toothed grin. Thorn took out a crown and held it up to one of the other bully boys.
"Ransom?"
The man hesitated a moment and then snatched the 5-shilling piece.
"Right you are, Captain. Worth it, I reckon, to see such a good throw. I'd get that pistol off her, though, and fast."
"Excellent advice." He retrieved his pistol from her trembling hands and uncocked it, but he kept it out. The room was still crowded, its mood still uncertain. They could be grabbed, tripped, even stabbed before they reached the door. Money alone might be cause. Women were cheap, and silver was rare. Was he thinking too much, assuming too much hazard, as his friends sometimes accused him of doing? How did one not think in a situation like this? Thinking wasn't creating a path out of here, however, and the knife man was beginning to struggle to his feet. Nearby faces were unreadable and could easily conceal a murderous interest in the contents of his pockets. Then the church bell began to toll. Everyone's interest shifted. It was too late for any service.
"The French?"
someone muttered, and others picked it up. Men stood, pushing back stools and benches. Some clattered over. From ancient times, church bells had called the men of the Kent coast to repel invasion. Despite the recent treaty of peace, no one down here, just 20 miles from Calais, trusted the French. To Thorn, it sounded more like the tolling for a death than an alarm sounded at invasion. But why toll a death so late at night? Then someone burst in, crying,
"The King's dead! George II's dead! Took a seizure this morning! Stone cold dead he is!"
Good God.
This was his moment, however.
"God save the new king, then," he bellowed. "The ale's on me. Drink up, lads. Drink up, and toast young George III.
As everyone turned to push toward the barrel, he grabbed the girl's arm again. When she fought him, he snapped,
"Don't be a fool."
"My cloak," she gasped.
He saw it puddled on the floor and let her pick it up and swing it on, before putting an arm around her and bullying their way toward the door of the chaotic rat. He was met there by a hard-eyed man, hand out, the tavern keeper. No time for haggling. Thorn took a half-guinea out of his secret pocket and passed it over. The man actually smiled and nodded his head.
"Thank ye, sir, and God bless the king indeed. It'll be mighty strange to have a new un."
Exceedingly. Thorn glanced around for the man who'd helped by revealing his identity and was winked at by an elderly man puffing peaceably on his pipe. He took the risk of going over to slip him a guinea. The man slid it into a pocket, nodding with dignity.
"God bless you, sir."
"And you." Then he had the girl outside. He hurried her down the quay until they were lost in the misty darkness. Thorn blessed the growing crowd. When he'd entered the rat, this area had been almost deserted, but now people were spilling out of buildings and perhaps coming from other areas of town to exclaim together over the news. The immediate danger was over. But what in Hades was he to do with this woman, especially now in this extraordinary moment? The old king had reigned for 33 years, as long as many here had memories, including himself. The king's eldest son, Frederick, had died some years back, so the new monarch was poor Fred's son, George, a man younger than Thorn himself, and under the thumb of his mother and his noble tutor, the Earl of Bute. Chaos threatened, and he needed to travel to London with all speed, but he had a reckless, stubborn millstone around his neck. She gathered her cloak around her and pulled up the hood against the damp chill, so he could see little of her face until she peered out at him. In a flat voice, she said,
"You're going to abandon me now."
"A pretty plea would work better, my girl." But pretty pleas didn't seem to be her style, to rapacious rascals or impatient rescuers. Part of him admired that. Or were her words simple cunning, making it hard to act that way? He deeply disliked being manipulated, and he was offended that she'd imagine he would abandon a young lady in this area at all, never mind on a night like this.
"You'd better come to my inn with me," he said shortly. "It's not far, and we can sort out your problem there."
"I doubt you'll find it so easy."
"You'd rather I didn't try. Then walk away." He sensed her flinch.
"No, I'm sorry. It's just difficult."
"I don't doubt it."
He put an arm around her to guide her through the growing crowd. She resisted for a moment, but then showed some sense. The mood was merry at the moment. Clearly celebrating the new rain was preferable to mourning the old. But it involved drink, a lot of drink, so this could soon become a riot.
"What were you doing in the Rat?" he asked.
"Is that the place's name? How appropriate."
"Well," he demanded.
"I..."
But then she turned and flung her arms around his neck, pressing hard against him. He instinctively put his arms around her, but then he grasped her wrists to pull her off. Devil take it. Was this an extremely contrived attempt to compromise him into marriage?
"No,"
she whispered desperately, clinging to his coat.
"Please."
Good God. He'd heard of women driven mad with promiscuous desire. Was this a case? Was that her purpose down here on the quay? He couldn't deny a touch of excited curiosity, so he kissed her parted lips. She became an icy statue, her lips closing tight. Not, alas, driven mad with promiscuous desire. Not even pretending enthusiasm in the hope of hooking his interest. That left only one explanation.
"Who are you hiding from?"
he whispered. She relaxed a little.
"Two men walking down the street."
The butterfly movements of her lips against his were surprisingly enticing, but not, it would seem, to her. He realized she wasn't interested in him at all. How novel. Chapter 2. Pretending to kiss, he turned them, looking around. With such a crowd, it should be impossible to spot her problem, but the two men stood out by being sober and purposeful. They were working their way through the crowd without obvious impatience, but steadily. One was cloaked, one not, and both wore three-cornered hats. They could be anything from upper servants to lords. Still holding her close, lips touching, he asked,
"Are you the villain, or are they?"
She stiffened.
"They, of course."
"Not emissaries of your family, seeking to return you to your home?"
"Absolutely not."
"It would be unwise to make a dupe of me."
In almost a snarl, she muttered,
"I wish I could tell you to go to the devil and take those men with you."
Thorn chuckled. He couldn't help it.
"It looks as if it's me or them, sweetheart. Better, perhaps, the devil you do not know."
She audibly inhaled, but agreed with a brusque,
"Very well."
He chuckled again. Damn it, but he liked the wench, for her blunt acceptance of the inevitable, if nothing else. But her unwomanly nature had probably thrown her into this situation and could easily make things worse. Whoever she was, whatever her situation, she should have stayed safe at home. They moved on, but he kept an eye on the men. One ducked into a tavern, while the other remained outside, scanning the crowd. Thorn regretted that he was tall, for even as he tried to drift them on the tide of people toward his inn, he and the girl must stand out. The hunters were looking for a woman alone, however, and one in quality clothing. Wise of her to hide that frivolous cap. But then he realized they might be distinctive simply by being sober and purposeful, just as the hunters were. When a drunken sailor collapsed against them, staggering them both, Thorn relieved the man of his tankard. The sailor contemplated his empty hand with bewildered, crossed eyes, and then bonelessly collapsed onto a coil of rope. Thorn waved the tankard and staggered onward, joining in a raucous rendering of a very dirty ditty.
"What are you doing?"
she protested.
"Hiding. Act as drunk as everyone else."
"I..."
Someone nearby began a ragged attempt at the newly popular song, "God Save the King." "God save our gracious king. Long live our noble king. God save the king." Thorn joined in, deliberately as out of tune as he could manage, weaving and staggering. All of a sudden, his companion staggered along with him, joining in the song in a vile nasal whine. Laughing, he swirled her in for a true kiss, catching her lips parted, touching tongues. She jerked back. "Drunk, remember?" he said, grinning.
"I am not drunk," she spat at him, but still swaying as if she were. "I, sir, have never been drunk."
"Poor creature. What a dull life."
"Some of us can have pleasure without wine."
"You must show me how," he said, watching the men join company and move closer in their search. "But for now, giggle."
"Giggle?"
He leaned closer and nipped her ear. She let out a yip, but then managed to turn it into a credible drunken shriek. She also kicked his shin. He wasn't wearing boots, and her shoes were solid. He staggered in truth, but kept a firm hold on her, so she almost lost her footing entirely. When she gained her balance, he gave her a hard slap on the rear. She whirled on him.
"You!"
Fortunately, blind rage made her sound like a fishwife. But they were a centre of attention now, with men and women calling encouragement to one or the other. Thorn thought he'd ruined everything, but then he saw that the hunters had dismissed this uproar as nothing to do with them and moved on past. He turned back to encounter her hand on his cheek. Her hit was feeble, so he just shook his head at her, grabbed her wrist, and dragged her onward. "I'll deal with you, my girl, when we're back home," he announced loudly. The crowd cheered them off, then returned to their revels, and soon they were free of the throng. He moved quickly into what shadows he could find, and then plunged down a narrow lane that would lead him to the back of the Compass Inn. "Clear for now," he said softly to the woman. "But they'll be at the Rat soon, and there they'll hear the whole story." She was still seething. It came off her like heat, but she said,
"Then they'll learn I'm with Captain Rose."
"Good girl," he said, impressed by her quick understanding and irritated to be a step behind her. "And someone will know where Captain Rose always stays." She pulled back.
"We must go elsewhere."
He tugged her onward. "My horse is at the Compass, and my other possessions. But we can be free of Dover in a quarter hour, and then you can explain all of this. Here we are." A couple of grooms were in the stable yard, one walking a heated horse and the other carrying a bucket. They knew him, but were surprised to see him approaching the inn from the back, especially with a woman. "Can I do something for you, Captain?" the one with the bucket asked. "Aye. The news of the king's death changes my plans. I need my horse and a pillion pad for the lady." "Aye, sir," the man said, but with a sharp look at the lady in question. Thorn looked at her too, but her hood still concealed her. Was she from Dover and fearful of being recognised? Or was she a well-known villain, a pickpocket or cutpurse, or even one of the sort to entice innocent young women into brothels? He couldn't believe it. She was too young, and though clever, not cunning or hard. "It'll be a few minutes," he said. "Do you need some food and drink before we leave?"
"No, thank you."
But then she asked,
"Where are you taking me?"
She tried to make it a bold demand, but fear trembled beneath her tone. If he was any judge, she was a gently bred young lady in serious trouble, which was a mess in too many ways to count. He needed to travel with all speed to London, but he accepted the inevitable. "Within reason, I'll take you where you need to go."
"Near Maidstone, then."
"A fair distance from here."
"Yes."
"So how did you come here?"
"By coach."
He had a feeling they could play question and answer all night, and in truth, he didn't want any more of her story than he needed to get her off his hands in a way his conscience could accept. Maidstone, then. It was en route to London, but alone he'd have made a stop before then at his home for a change of clothing and his travelling chariot, in which he could catch some sleep on the journey. "Is there nowhere closer?" he asked.
"No."
"If we ride through the night, we might not get to Maidstone before morning, especially two to a horse. If you haven't been missed by now, you will be by then."
"Yes."
He wanted to shake her, and concerns about marriage plots were stirring again. But how could this young woman have staged that situation in the Rat, on the off chance that he would pass by and decide to rescue her? If she found out later who he was, however, she might try to take advantage of it. If they travelled overnight, she might claim to be compromised. Yet, he couldn't abandon her, and it would take too much time to hire a coach and a maid to play chaperone. A coach would make tracking them child's play. Devil take it, he was hungry. He'd expected to be peacefully at his supper now.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?